Catherine's Wish, a novel by Linda Lappin about the lives of Catherine Mansfield, John Middleton Murray, and Ida Baker, published by Wordcraft of Oregon, 2008. Selections read by the author. Part 1, Bandol, Hotel Beau Rivage, 1918. The train pulled on through the blizzard. Catherine pressed the small of her back against the seat and took short, tremulous breaths to keep herself from coughing. The stuffy air in the compartment was pervaded by the sickening smell of mothballs, perspiration, and wet galoshes, wafting forth from the gentleman in the gray overcoat sitting opposite her. At Calais, he had poked in his head with a hearty, "Alone, madam?" then bundled in and plopped down before she could protest. He now snoozed blissfully, a newspaper spread over his face, snuffling beneath a map of the latest German offensive, while the pool of melted snow at his feet slowly seeped towards her side of the compartment. If Ida had been there, she would have shooed him away and dried the puddle. But luckily or unluckily, Ida's request for a visa had been denied, and she was forced to stay behind. She was now in Catherine's flat in Old Church Street, watching over Catherine's cat. Murray could not be trusted with such an important task. There was no room for a pet at his lodgings in Redcliffe Road, and he was too busy with his new job at the War Office to bother with a cat. To Catherine, Ida's absence was cause for rejoicing. She hoped Murray might possibly be prompted to join her in Bandol, knowing that she was ill and alone while traveling abroad without Ida's assistance. That was not likely to be soon. Murray's war work was considered vital. It might be months before he could obtain leave. Still, she had begged Ida not to make a second request for a visa, and Ida, unwillingly, had agreed. Outside, the snow swirled down to the boughs of skeletal trees. The country road following the tracks was quickly filling in with white. A small fox, or perhaps a hare, bounded across a field, leaving a jagged trail in the snow. Yet the quiet countryside could not assuage Catherine's restlessness. She had been sitting there for hours. She would be sitting for hours more. The train stopped in every station on the line, where the engine died with a groan. After an interminable wait, it lurched to life again, jolted forward with a great burst of steam, then inched reluctantly along to the next stop. No one knew the reason for the delay. It was the war, they said. She yearned for something hot to drink, but the restaurant car was closed. There was not a cup of tea to be had anywhere on the train. That, too, because of the war. Whatever was wrong these days, it was the war, and one had to be resigned to it. Her feet burned, her back ached, her head throbbed. She shifted in her seat to soothe a cramped knee and frowned as she thought that Ida would not be there tonight to massage her painful tendons. How would she manage all those heavy bags? Perhaps it was unwise of her to venture so far into France, alone with the war on. But the doctors had insisted she could not weather another English winter without grave risks to her health. And look at it now, the worst snowstorm in over 20 years. Just imagine what it was like in London. She prayed she would be able to manage well enough. She was, after all, an old hand at traveling. And this wasn't her first trip alone abroad in wartime. She had already challenged the French border officials when she had followed her lover, Francis Carco, to the front 3 years ago. There in the little town of Grey, she had spent 3 days in a tawdry pension, under a false name, waiting for Carco to knock at the door as she imagined bullets whizzing by the window. What an adventure! As for Karko, whatever had she seen in him? He was no war hero, only the postman for a bakery unit, and not even much of a rider. It was only to rankle Murray that she had consented to that rendezvous which had been so disappointing in the end. And then Karko had offended them both by making caricatures of them in his recent novel. That just showed you can never trust a writer with your confessions. What was Murray doing now? Scribbling at his desk at the War Office? Writing clever phrases for recruitment posters? Or wooing that vixen Lady Audeline who once claimed to be her friend? Now that Murray was in service to his country, he could not leave England to follow her to France, but he could gad about London, making love to all her so-called friends. Upon her return, she would put an end to all that by marrying Murray, once her divorce from George Bowden came through at last. What a terrible mistake that had been, marrying Bowden on the spur of the moment, simply because he adored her and seemed so well connected. Of course, that wasn't the real reason she had let George rush her to the altar. The real reason had been the fatherless child in her womb, Garnett's child, the baby she had later lost in Bavaria. And that had all been Mother's fault. She would never have miscarried if Mother hadn't sent her to that dreadful spa to get her away from Ida. George Bowden. How he had worshipped her! The vibrato of his tenor voice had always grated on her nerves. But he had seemed so manly and sophisticated, and by marrying him she had thought she might punish and escape her family. When one is young, desperate, friendless, and penniless, half-baked solutions sometimes seem practical, even auspicious. Their marriage had not even lasted 24 hours before she had flown the coop with Ida's assistance. They had laughed about it afterwards. Good God! Impossible to think that 9 years had passed since then. She sighed and suddenly missed Ida, upon whose dumpy bosom she often rested her small, sleek head. It was going to take all her reserves of courage and energy to see herself through this time alone in France. Courage she had plenty, energy much less. At least she was returning to a hotel where the owner knew her well. Madame Gall would surely fatten her up again on butter and cream, quite unavailable in England with the rationing, and help her replenish her strength. Catherine had written ahead to reserve the same room which she had occupied during her last stay in Bandol, just before Marion had joined her there and they had moved out to the Villa Pauline on the edge of town. She smiled, thinking of the villa where she and Murray had been so happy together. The crisp sheets scented with lavender, the gleaming marble floor splashed with sunlight, the mimosa trees out the window frothing yellow in the sea breeze. She pictured the two of them sitting at the breakfast table, surrounded by piles of books and papers, she so seductive in her emerald kimono. Murray looking so dignified in his burgundy-striped silk dressing gown, he doing his work, she hers, and the table strewn with eggshells and milk bottles and empty pots of creme fraiche. Murray standing before the mirror of the armoire, asking anxiously, "Have they cut my hair too short?" At her negative reply, he had ventured, "Then have they left it too long?" She chuckled, remembering this episode, then felt something snag in her chest. The sting of tears astonished her. No one would ever understand why such a scene was her ideal of domestic bliss. And now, how much time would pass before she saw Mary again? This trip to France, they had vowed, would be her last trip alone. He had promised her that after they were married, hopefully in May, or as soon as her divorce came through, he would never allow her to travel abroad again without him. The dry air tickled her throat. She coughed with a wheezing, raucous croak, most unladylike, downright disgusting. The dozing gentleman grumbled and twitched beneath his newspaper. Alone or not, thought Catherine, as she observed the corpulent form slumped across from her, whatever happened, she had a secret friend, a hidden helper, a pistol purchased just before departure on the advice of her father. "My dear girl," he had urged in a letter from Wellington, "for heaven's sake, get a gun and learn to shoot." Father was so practical about that sort of thing. Who would imagine that this delightful London lady in her smart clutch and grey tweed travelling suit was packing a pistol in her handbag? She imagined pulling it out now and pointing the polished blue barrel at the snoring gentleman. Catching a glimpse of her reflection in the dark window as the train threaded a tunnel, she nodded slyly to herself. With a flask of brandy in her overcoat pocket and a pistol in her purse, this little New Zealander was ready for anything.